a Tuesday, and it's Bob McCowan. It's John Shannon.
Hello, Robert.
Where are your glasses, Shannon? You almost always wear your glasses these days, now that you're really old and gray.
Thank you for that, Bob.
You're welcome.
Would you like me to put them on?
No, I'm just curious. You know, people generally wear glasses because they can't see. No. Are you being vain now in your advancing years, or what is new? You don't have contact lenses in, do you?
No, I was just wanting to see if anybody noticed.
Well, I did, and so you should be pleased.
Yeah, well, you know what?
Did you ever wear contacts?
Oh, for about 6 minutes.
Oh, really? Didn't like them?
Too much work. Too much work.
I wore them for years and years.
It's like peeling an orange. Too much work, Bob. You know?
It's a vanity thing, don't you think? And I mean, you get to the point in life where you go, screw vanity.
I don't know. I own about 8 or 9 pair of glasses. Different, you know, I use glasses like a lot of guys use ties, whatever mood you're in and whether it complements the suit and tie you're wearing. So.
Well, thank you for that.
Well, you know, I can put them on if you'd like.
No, John, it's okay. It's intriguing because I see you every bleeping day.
And don't sound so enthused.
I'm not enthused. Make no mistake about it.
But, I used to be able to play golf. I should stop the sentence there. But I used to be able to play golf without my glasses. And now I can't. I have to use them to play golf. So,
well, when you first started, you know, when I gave you your big break in broadcasting.
That was you, was it?
An on-air talent.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Well, as an on-air talent.
Yeah.
In which an occupation in which you have flourished, John.
Oh, thank you, Robert. Thank
you. You'll note the extreme sincerity in that comment.
Well, I can't see you, so.
No, well, but you used to come on most of the time without your glasses on. And
did I?
And, yeah, you did.
Really?
And then I always noted that you did, and I always thought, well, it's understandable. It was a little bit of vanity. And it's only when you actually wanted to read. There are many people like that.
No, I've never cared whether I wear my glasses or not on the air. No.
Well, see, I wear mine all the time because I can't see. Excuse me. I don't have the option of taking them off. Anyway, we got to get out of here because we got a good guest. Well, we always have good guests, but Bruce Boudreau, former coach, maybe a coach again. I hope he is. Will join us when we come back after these messages. It's McCowan. It's Shannon with you on this Tuesday. We thank you for joining us. We are joined by a pal, a friend, a buddy, a chum, a good all-round guy. The former coach of a variety of teams, most recently Minnesota, I believe, if memory serves me correctly.
I was going to say the Manchester Monarchs.
That was back in the day.
Yeah.
Bruce Boudreau is with us. Gabby, you look beautiful. How are you?
I'm doing well, guys. How are you?
We're great. We have not played golf this year. We may not play golf this year. Have you played at all?
Yeah, I play all the time.
Thank you.
Well, at least our courses are open now. So.
Yeah, well, one guy can play at a time, right? In Ontario now? Or can you get a foursome going?
I think it's one player per day per course.
Okay.
So you can play fast.
You know, there's nothing worse than a former person from Ontario rubbing it in about Ontario. That's the.
And I used to brag about Canada so often.
I know.
But all right, I got a question that's kind of out of the weeds that I've been thinking about. So I spent the first 20 odd years of my life as a fan and watching games and cheering for teams. And then I got into this racket and realized very quickly you kind of have to have a little more neutrality. And so I lost a lot of that fan feeling and emotion when I'm watching a game. I try and watch it a little more clinically and whatever. And I was thinking about you and going through this season, but more importantly, this playoff. Do you feel like when you sit down and watch a game on television, you watch it as if you were a coach, or can you actually enjoy a game?
Well, I think I watch it as a coach, but I still cheer for a different team, if that makes any sense. Like, no, I will watch it analytically, but I will hope one team does better than the other.
And what's the basis for your fandom? Is it, I mean, are you attached? Well, here's another one. Are you attached to the teams that you used to coach? Is that relationship ongoing, or is it the exact opposite? Like, you hope they get their asses kicked.
Well, I think, let's say for Toronto, I hope they win, because being from Toronto and being a former Leaf, and I've never worked for them. Yeah. So, I mean, I've got no axe to grind. I did get cut by them a lot, but that was so far long ago. I think time has taken care of that. But, you know, as a fan, I would say Minnesota's playing Vegas tonight. I would cheer for certain individuals on Minnesota, but want Vegas to win. I mean, the young guys that you developed and you've seen, or helped to develop, and you've seen them come up and play great, you really want them to continue doing great. As an organization, whether it be them, whether it be Anaheim, whether it be Washington, you sort of hope that they don't have the success because you're not there. It's a little selfish, but I think it's human nature.
Well, it's fair. Well. Sure.
So let me ask you this. So most of our Canadian audience wouldn't know, but you are doing some work at the NHL Network in the United States. Does that change when you go into the studio and work at the NHL Network, or do you have to take that fandom hat off at all?
Yeah, I take the fandom hat off totally there. It's just when I'm working, it's all about what is happening before in front of me and just analyzing that the best I can. If your favorite player makes a dumb mistake, I'm still saying that he made a dumb mistake. But I do look at it way more from a coach's standpoint than a player's standpoint. That's, I think, the one thing they like at the NHL Network, that I'm looking at it that way.
Have you enjoyed your TV time?
I really have. I mean, I've enjoyed it. I enjoy working, and I enjoy just talking hockey all the time when you don't get a chance to talk it. What is sometimes a little boring is staying in Secaucus, New Jersey, and during the pandemic, for the most part, with nothing to do until you go to work. That's that gets a little long in the tooth, especially because you go a week at a time. And I was doing usually about 13 to 14 days a month there. So there's not a lot to do other than the work, which is great. It's a lot of fun.
Well, you're not alone in that. We've all gone through something, not maybe a parallel, but similarly, of looking for stuff to do other than work, and without success. So when you are watching a game, you mentioned watching players and being able to critique, assess their performance. Do you do the same thing with coaches? And do you think you're more critical, perhaps, of decisions that coaches make, where you say, I don't know why he did that?
No, you know what? I'm trying to stay away from coaches. And it's too, when I criticize, I really watch who I'm criticizing, because, you know, I still want to get into coaching. So I got to watch, like, if I'm really critical about one player and he hears something and I end up coaching that team, it's a little different. It's a little difficult. But at the same time, I don't want to be not true to the audience and look like I'm just out there not being the right critic. You know, I mean, you praise the good stuff, but if you're sitting there and you're going, Jesus, that was a pretty bad goal on Samsonov by Bergeron on Sunday. And, you know, you've got to say that, and you've got to say he's got to be better. Or if, you know, if there's mistakes to be made, like in Sunday's game, if, you know, Edmonton doesn't get if what's his name doesn't trip that guy or go low on him,
Archibald,
in the third period, Archibald. Then, you know, Archibald, yeah, I'm definitely saying this was a thoughtless play, and I would definitely have said I'm a little surprised that Tippett put him back on the ice. And I would have said, I'm a little surprised Tippett didn't call a timeout after the third goal just to calm the team down. But I wasn't working. So those are the things I said in my head.
Okay. So you generated two questions for me. Earlier in the week, Samsonov made a terrible play behind the net. Craig Smith scored in overtime for the Bruins to take the lead. That wasn't the mistake I'm worried about. Alex Ovechkin on the bench reamed his ass in front of everybody in Russian. It was pretty obvious what he was doing to this young goaltender. To me, that looked like a tipping point, a watershed moment where, hey, how's the captain doing this in front of everybody in the arena itself? What would you have said to Ovi at that point after the game?
Well, you know what? I take a different slant on that whole thing. I've seen Ovi talk to Semin, talk to Orlov in Russian. And because I think they're tighter and they're all Russian, they feel they can say things to each other. I would have ventured to guess that the next morning they were best friends again. And it was just emotion coming out over Alex. And to be quite frankly, I didn't even blame Samsonov. To me, it was all Schultz's fault. But and I can go into detail why I thought that. But I don't know if you guys remember years ago, I had an argument with Ovi on the bench. And when I didn't put him out for a shift and he was saying things to me. So we met the next morning and he said, yeah, I'm okay. I was just hot-headed at the time because I wanted to play and you didn't play me, but it all worked out and it's good. So we're good to go. I think the same thing would have happened with Samsonov and Ovi the next day. They might have had a meeting in the room and Ovi would have said, okay, you know, we made a mistake. We're right there. Let's move on.
The other one is, is how do you use timeouts, Bruce? Because the only reason I ask is Dave Tippett, through his career, has been hesitant to use timeouts. He thinks it shows the players on his team a sign of panic, that the coach is panicking. How do you use timeouts?
Well, I mean, I think it's sometimes in that situation, I would have, it's to calm down. It's not a panic. It's to settle everything down. Take 30 seconds and take a deep breath. Here, boys, we're still leading and everything else. Sometimes the emotion on the other team is so great, they can't wait for the puck to drop. And it's like a batter stepping out of the batter's box a couple times when a pitcher's striking everybody out, you know, just to calm down and get them out of their rhythm a little bit. But you usually wait, if you can afford to wait, for the timeout to be when you pull the goalie. And the reason is a lot of teams only have one unit that they can put out there or six different guys. Nowadays you usually pull the goalie with 2 minutes to 2.5 minutes to go in the game if it's a one goal deficit. And so, I mean, that's a long time to stay on the ice and you get exhausted. So if you get a faceoff, you can call a timeout, regroup, and do it again or set up a face-off play. I don't think it's a sign of weakness at all, quite frankly. I think it's a strategic thing that if you don't do it, the players think, you know, you're not thinking strategy enough.
With Bruce Boudreau, you mentioned something that inspires a question for me that I had never thought about before. You're talking about two players, two Russians, talking to each other in Russian. I'm sure at some point in your career, you've had, maybe in every place you've been, two guys from whose principal language, whose first language is something other than English, who are on the same team. And it is probably natural for them to converse in their own language. Is that problematic for you? I mean, you don't. I assume you don't speak any Russian. I doubt you speak any Swedish. You know, has that ever been an issue where you've had to say, "Hey, guys, you know, the language of the team, of the league, of the game, even in Montreal for the most part, is English"?
Yeah, we talk about it all the time. I mean, if you're talking with your fellow teammate and it's just to him, you can talk whatever you. whatever you want if you're by yourself. But when you're with a group and they don't know the language, English is the language that we use in the dressing room all the time. Because the last thing, and it's happened a couple of times where players say, "Hey, what are you talking about? Are you talking about me?"
Yeah.
You know, and you don't want that. So, I mean, you, and it's easy to do if they're speaking in a different language, you know, like, I mean, I would be sitting there worried if they were talking about me being the just the personality I am. So we always meant it as a rule that if you're in the room or around the guys, you speak English. When you're by yourself, you know, and you're on your own with somebody, speak whatever language you want.
Well, I don't know if you've ever been in that situation. I actually have. In Quebec, where I was in a store and I had a surly person behind the counter who swore at me in French because he thought I didn't know how to speak French, which I don't, but I know a few phrases.
There's a couple of words that I'm sure you recognize.
As you would too, Boudreaux, yes.
Yes.
And he uttered one of those, and I fired back with the appropriate response, which put him back on his heels. But I understand that, you know, language can be problematic. It's just another thing now in the National Hockey League that you kind of have to deal with, right?
100% you have to deal with it. And because there's so many people on every team that are from different, you know, areas of the world, that it could become a problem if you don't set that rule up right off the bat. And I mean, there's nothing more. We're all curious. And like, if I'm going to a room and two guys look at me and then they start talking back and forth in a different language, I'm going, "Whoa, baby, slow down."
Hey, actually, yeah. Bruce, I got a story you'd appreciate. So this is 1978 or 79. I'm a young gun working at Hockey Night in Canada. We're in Boston with the Canadians during one of their playoff series. And I walk into the bar at the Royal Sonesta Hotel in Cambridge. And sitting at a table, there are six Francophone players of the Montreal Canadiens, including Guy Lafleur, Guy Lapointe, and a few others. And Lapointe waves me over and says, "Come and sit with us and have a beer," which was rather a treat for a kid 20 years old. And I get to sit with the Montreal Canadiens. And the conversation started in French, and Lafleur said, "No, no, no. John is here. He only speaks English. We have to finish the conversation in English." And that told me a lot about that group of guys as a Montreal Canadian. You just tweaked me to that story.
Yeah, you were probably playing the Leafs, and that's why you were there.
Bruins.
The Bruins. 78 or 79.
Bruins. Oh, okay. Bruins. Yeah.
After they beat the Leafs.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
One of the other things we chatted very briefly about before we started doing the show, Bruce is on an iPad now.
Yeah.
And that is one of the not so recent, but relatively speaking, recent evolutions, technical evolutions in the game, is the appearance, and we see it all the time on television, of the iPad behind on the bench. I was going to say behind the bench, but both on the bench and behind the bench. Is this a technology that you like or hate?
It's a good question. There's, you know, we've all been taught, the older guys, that the focus on the game, focus on the guy you're supposed to be up next, and you got to look at, watch where he is, so you don't have any too many men on the ice penalties, or you don't miss a shift in that. And now you see the guys looking down. I think it really causes an awful lot of too many men on the ice penalties, especially early on in the season. But I mean, it's like anything else. It's like analytics. It's you can't stop the advancement or so-called advancement of hockey. I would rather it not be done. And that's why you have so many coaches on the bench, to be able to tell them what they're supposed to be able to do. But you there? Did I lose?
Yeah, we're here.
There?
Yeah.
Yep. It is what it is. And you can't stop, you know, the new technology, or you get it, and if you don't believe in it or don't try to learn it, then all of a sudden you get left behind, and people, you know, they don't want you anymore. quite frankly.
Are we all a bunch of beyond middle-aged curmudgeons with all of this
stuff? Hey, speak for yourself. Come on.
Well, you know, I mean, I think there are things that have changed. Well, I know there are things that have changed in all sports. And some things are for those of us of a certain age who are used to doing things a different way, it's tough to adapt. And I think we are all naturally resistant to change, aren't we, Gabby?
We are. I mean, but I put it in my head, Bob, that if I don't change and I don't adapt, then I'll be left behind. I don't want to change. I don't want to change. I love doing, you know, still I get my yellow notepad and I still do all my notes, like writing at while I'm watching the computer, doing things of that nature. But I've got to learn and I got to not that I don't understand it, but I got to accept the analytics as they're a big part of every sport now, no matter what sport you're looking at, they're there. And some are important numbers, some are not important numbers, but if you don't accept it and look at it, then you're going to be left behind.
Yeah, so on that point, when you look at all these numbers, because everybody's got different versions of what analytics are, what's the one, is there one that stands out for you that you think that probably helps you more than any other?
Yeah, you know what? I like, they call them entries. I just, for me, it's turnovers at the blue line and how many times you got the puck behind the defense and then the results of that as to turning pucks over and going the other way, because teams are so fast and so good now in the transition game that if you keep turning it over, then you're going to be in trouble. I mean, my last year in Minnesota, when we got Kevin Fiala, his biggest thing that I had to change was he turned the puck over twice as much as any other player we had on the team. So I would be able to say, Kevin, I can't play you if you're going to keep doing this. And you show him the numbers, and and eventually he got a lot better at it, that he wouldn't try to deep everybody at the blue line. If it was an odd man rush, yes. But if it wasn't, get it behind the defense and dump and chase. And that way you don't get into trouble. The other one is high danger area shots. I take a lot of thing in. If you can limit those high danger areas, then all of a sudden, you know, you get a goalie that can stop a puck that you're going to be successful.
So, and your definition of high danger shots is between the dots?
Yeah, from the post to the dot, across to the other dot and to the post. Mm-hmm. Those are the things. And we took a lot of pride in not allowing that. If you look at Minnesota's team, they haven't changed the system and they led the league in the fewest high danger shots allowed. And the problem last year, and I'll say it, is we led the league with the fewest high danger shots, but we had the worst save percentage in the high danger shots. So that's not a good combination to have, you know. So one part was good, one part was really bad.
Let's take the quick break. Bruce Brudeau is with us, and we'll continue after these messages. It's McCowan, it's Shannon, it's Bruce Boudreau on the program for today. You were talking about danger zone.
High danger.
Yeah, the NHL today has morphed into a game. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, where I feel like 90% of the offense is generated from the point, from the blue line, by shots from the blue line, which raised an interesting question for me. Is accuracy of a shot from the blue line now much more important than power from the blue line? For the longest time, we used to revel in guys who had big slap shots from the point, who could fire it past somebody because of the velocity they could generate. In fact, when they used to do skill competitions with hardest shot, many times it was defensemen who had the hardest shot. But I wonder if that matters nearly as much now as somebody who can, you know, put it where they want to. Is this something you've thought about?
Yeah, very much so. And it, to me, it's And you'll see an awful lot of defensemen now, they don't even take slap shots. Mm. They just, you know, I mean, wrist shots, snap shots, whatever you want to call it. And because it's all about getting through, because now teams, what they do is they bring all five guys back to the middle of the ice. And then, so you've got to go through layers. And it's, the goalies can stop anything. Like, I mean, you know, the top of the circles used to be such a deadly area. If there's nothing in front of the goalie at the top of the circles, they still make 90%+ of the stops. So velocity doesn't really matter. It's placement of the shots. And with everybody blocking them, and you, we teach the forwards now to go to the front of the net, get the goal, get, take the eyes out away from the goalie, that it's just seeing eye shots that, that go in. And I mean, in Sunday's game in Winnipeg, you saw the fourth goal by Morrissey was just a little wrist shot, but he couldn't, you know, Smith didn't see it. And that, mm-hmm. those are the ones that go in because people block everything else because the equipment is so strong and so good now that they don't worry about the shot impact as long as it's under the shoulder pads.
Well, and you talk about accuracy. It's a lot easier, I would assume. It's kind of like golf to control a wrist shot or a non-slap shot than it is to control a slap shot where it goes.
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, the example I use is Ryan Suter never takes a slap shot, but he wants to get it through that, past that first layer. If you can get it past that first layer, the puck is going to lie somewhere where if you have are outnumbering their guys, you're usually going to get the rebound. And that's why statistically that, like, I think it was 75% of the goals in the NHL are scored within 5 feet of the blue paint. So you get it to the blue paint and you just muck it up and the winning team is the win team that wins those battles.
Well, Austin Matthews is the number one goal scorer in the NHL. How many slap shots did he score on this year, would you say, John?
None.
I would say probably pretty close to none. I don't remember any. There may have been one or two, but
yeah. I don't think those leading goal scorers. The guy at the top of the scoring list that uses a slap shot more than anybody else is Leon Draisaitl. But that's in power play situations when you've moved the goaltender laterally and he's got a half a net to play with his slap shot and his release is spectacular.
Yeah. Cause Connor's taken four guys this way and passed it over to him, you know, cause I don't remember Connor McDavid scoring on a slap shot goal either or not too often.
Not too often. You're right, Bruce.
Well, the classic, we were talking about Ovechkin earlier, the classic Ovechkin goal. If you're envisioning an Ovechkin goal, I think we all know what it looks like. You know, he's around the dot and a cross ice pass and he one times the slap shot, but there aren't that many guys that can do that.
And if you look, I don't know the number, but I think he scored 5 or 6 power play goals this year.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when he shoots the puck with the slap shot. Everything else is him crossing half the ice and shooting the other way with a wrist shot that has got as much velocity on it as any of his slap shots, or he goes to the net and bullies his way in and gets those easy tap-ins.
We are, we confess that we are recording this broadcast a day in advance. And so we're not going to spend too much time going through specifics of too many series because things will change. But Colorado has swept. This is a team that everybody has touted since the beginning of the year. I think my judgment has sort of been reserved because they have not had long-term playoff success. We acknowledge everybody knows that they're very good. And they're in a division against another very good team, the Golden Knights, who almost inevitably they will face next. What is it about Colorado that makes them this good?
Well, okay, I can compare them a little bit. They've got a line that is as good as Boston's production line in McKinnon, Rantanen, and Landeskog. But what they've got that sets them apart is their defense are so fast and mobile and offensive minded that they are the best team in the league for the defense to jump into the play and their forwards are quick enough that pushes other teams back, that they're able to give the puck to the fourth man, which is the defenseman, if it's Makar, if it's Girard, if it's whomever. And they really put you on your heels most of the game. And they're they shoot more pucks than anybody. They shoot from every angle and go to the net. They do a lot of things really well. And then Grubauer's having a year that he's never had before. So I know when we used to play them, and being in the West and being actually in their division, we play them 2 preseason games, 5 regular season games. And if you got the chance to play them in the playoffs, that's another group. I mean, our goal was to stop MacKinnon and not worry about anybody else. But now they've got more weapons than MacKinnon. And I don't think the loss of Kadri hurts them at all. And they will be hard pressed to beat. But in my mind, I think the 2 best teams in the NHL are Colorado and Vegas, and they have to meet in the second round of the playoffs. So it's going to be very interesting.
Well, that raises another one for me. I'm glad you brought this one up, because I thought about, I've had this opinion for the longest time. I do not, guys, understand why seeding is important in the first round, but all of a sudden seeding matters not at all in subsequent rounds. And why do you have arguably, as Gabby said, the 2 best teams perhaps in the NHL? How is it that they will meet in
anomaly. This is an anomaly, Bob. This is a year that we got through. Not really.
Well, if the two best teams in the league over the course of the season, and by the acknowledgement of all, and most importantly by points, are both in the Western Conference, they can't meet in the Stanley Cup final. If the 2 best teams are in the American League in baseball, they can't meet in the World Series. If the 2 best teams are in the NFC in football, they can't meet in the Super Bowl.
Luck of the draw, Bob.
On and on we go.
Luck of the draw, Bob. It's luck of the draw.
Well, but why should we have a luck of the draw?
Because regional rivalries drive things. Bruce, you know this. Regional rivalries drive sports. When you were in Minnesota, when you were in Washington, I'll tell you what, when the Flyers came to town, it was a zoo, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And that's why you play them 5 times a year and the other teams just 2 times a year.
Right.
I see both points, and I agree with Bob in that, wouldn't it be nice after the first round? And they used to do this in the NHL when they seeded 1-16, I think.
Only for about 3 years.
Yeah, but where the teams in the same division could meet each other for the Stanley Cup. But it would be nice to if those 2 teams in out west could meet for the Stanley Cup. But I think the downside is that you've got all these people that don't see those Western teams all the time, and they want to cheer for a team in the East because that's where they're from. So you want to have the best of the East versus the best of the West, and I think that makes it better. Even though I'd like to see both of those teams being able to somehow meet in the semifinals or something, you know.
But you 2 guys are just absolutely full of it. I mean, what we all want to see is the 2 best teams in a championship. Playoff rounds, you sell your tickets. Your fans of the Boston Bruins want to see the Boston Bruins win. They don't care who they beat. The rivalry issue is important during the regular season if you want to sell tickets and get eyeballs on a meaningless 1 of 82 games. When you get to the playoffs, hockey fans are all in front of the television set, and it doesn't matter. Rivalries... is there greater intensity? I suppose. Oof. But I mean, Toronto's playing Montreal. Are more people inclined to watch that series than if Toronto was playing Winnipeg and Montreal was playing Edmonton? I don't think so. I don't think there's any evidence to support that. Gabby, jump in.
I think you're wrong, but I've thought you've been wrong
you're
for
wrong.
30 years. But I would think if Toronto was playing Montreal, all those people in Quebec, that you know, they've got a team to cheer for. Now, if LA was playing Anaheim and those people in Quebec don't know anything about those two teams because they haven't seen them all year or they haven't been able to watch them because it's too late, they're not really going to care who wins if those two teams were the teams playing for the championship. You have to have some sort of team that you can latch on to, whether it was the team that beat your team or a team you saw and you know all the players from, to at least cheer for. And I think that's what sports they go for, and at least in hockey, that they go for that, that they want, they need more viewership, they need more people watching. So, you know, I think this is the way to do it.
With your logic, Bob, then they should just, they should give the President's Trophy winner, just give them a bye all the way to the Stanley Cup final, and then have the other 15 teams play each other, and the second place team overall gets there too. I mean, that's why they play the games, Bob. Here's the thing. When Bruce was talking about Colorado shooting from anywhere, the team that jumped to my mind that it was does the same thing all the time is Carolina. Carolina shoots from everywhere too.
Yeah.
And they may not get out of the first round.
Well, I don't, you know, to get back to your point, you want to talk about hockey on the ice. I mean, we can certainly morph into that conversation, but to answer your, well, it wasn't a question as usual with you. It's a statement.
That's all you do is ask questions.
Well, that's what I do. but if you want to make the regular season truly impactful and valuable and not an 82 game slog, which is what it is, then give the best team over the course of those 82 games the advantage. Reseed after every round. One plays 16, then if one advances, one plays 8 or whoever the lowest seed is, and you keep doing it that way. And I don't care about divisions, and I don't care about conferences, and rivalries are relevant only during the regular season to sell tickets. They're not relevant during the playoffs. Rivalries are, and Gabby, you will know this. Rivalries are more often than not developed, created during playoff seasons rather than during the regular season.
I agree with you because I think they're manufactured or they're wished about in the regular season. But if you have, like, you would never think that Detroit and Colorado was a great rivalry in the 90s. But I mean, because they had that playoff and it was so violent and noteworthy, every time they played in the early 2000s, it was a great rivalry because something was going to happen.
Well, you're sort of morphing to the point.
Yeah, I know, Bruce. You've kind of swayed. You're moving to the other side.
You know, that's it's almost like I'm a politician, right? I'm sorry.
Don't apologize. I appreciate that you've found the.
Just don't agree with Bob.
I've seen the light. Is yes, that you have. Trying to say?
Hey, Bruce, are you going to coach in the NHL next year?
I would really like to. I mean, but the decision isn't mine, right? I'd like to think that I'm still capable. I mean, I'm pretty sure I have the energy and I think I have the knowledge. And so, I mean, you know, but it needs somebody to really want me to do that job. And I mean, I'm still hoping for the opportunity, but you never know.
So do you, not to put you on the spot, do you have some interviews planned?
I haven't talked to any NHL team, but okay. Through my agent, I've heard that there's two teams that want to interview me. So I'll just hope that something happens this week is my timetable sort of thing. And, you know, and then we'll see if we go from there.
Have you thought about, I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot, and I really don't, but there is I won't mention the team. There is an expansion team coming into the league. You have not coached an expansion team. And I'm guessing that is a very different process. Have you thought about that and whether that intrigues you or does it scare you a little?
No, it intrigues me. I love, you know, I mean, I don't think I get scared of anything, whether it's taking a last place club or a first place club. I love the challenges of everything. And I think the excitement of an expansion team is really, really interesting. Like I've taken expansion teams at lower levels and teams that have just come into the, you know, the first year into existence. And I've always found it really, really exciting. And, you know, I mean, the fact that you don't know, I mean, we're obviously talking about Seattle. I mean, that you don't know one player on the team. They don't have no one player on the team right now. That would be a pretty exciting thing. And you look what Vegas did. And everybody says that's not going to happen because people have smartened up now. But I disagree. I think you're going to still be able to get quality players off of every team. You just won't be able to make the trades that maybe Mr. McPhee did to garnish some of the great draft choices they had to get in Vegas.
Well, the one thing you would get is you get to create, and I mean that in the most sincere way, create a team the way you want. You don't have to start by undoing things that other people did that you don't necessarily agree with. Mm-hmm. You get a completely blank slate when you start an expansion team, right?
Yeah, and I think it would be important that the coach and the GM are thinking the same way, because if you don't have a coach yet before the draft, that the GM is probably designing the team the way he would like it to be, mm-hmm. and then you got to find a coach that thinks the exact same way as you do to get the things working together. But if you have a coach and GM that are both talking before, obviously you pick players and you could find out what kind of team you want, then I'm sure the GM is going to pick a coach that is thinking like him, then all of a sudden it makes it so much easier and so much more exciting to get all the players that you're going to get.
You know, Bob and I have talked about this a couple of times in that Seattle is a very interesting market. Sure, there's hockey around there. There's junior teams in and around the Pacific Northwest. But how, in your last job, for instance, how much of your job was actually coaching players and the other part was talking to media and dealing with outside influences? And I would think in a place like Seattle, the outside influences would play a bigger role.
Well, when you're trying to grow the team, I think it really is a big role. And I think they'll have to find somebody that is very cooperative with the media and at the same time, interesting to the media. But I mean, your main goal is to win hockey games. The NHL coaches, now, if you don't win, you don't, you know, it's a win now league. And I don't think there's a lot of ownerships that have a lot of patience. And if you don't win, they just find somebody else.
Well,
but I do believe that the media portion of it is very important to grow a team. It was definitely probably 50% of my job in Mississippi and in Muskegon, Michigan, and in Lowell, Mass, and in Manchester when I started new teams there.
A lot of chicken dinners, huh?
a lot of food in general.
We all experience that from time to time. We'll let you go. I like the Gretzky thing in the background. Is there some significance to that particular poster?
No, you? This is just my my wine room, and I've got jerseys up all over the place. And this was one Wayne gave me when he played with the Rangers. So we just set it up here. I could have put it another place, and I got Ovechkin in the background. But this, I like it when Wayne ever sees these things that he knows I'm thinking about him.
I don't want the phone call. I don't want the phone call from Ovi in Russian yelling at you. That's all.
So I've had that before. I didn't like it. I got fired a week later, by the way.
Bruce, it's great to see you. You're a gentleman for joining us. We always appreciate it. We love having you on, and we'll do it again somewhere down the road. And even more importantly, I hope you get a chance to hit that little white ball sometime this summer.
Well, I do. And thanks for having me. But even more importantly, like that, I'd like to come back home and see family and friends. So I know, I hope things work out up there so we can do that.
Well, we got our fingers crossed that we're moving in the right direction now, and that it won't be too much longer. So
that sounds great. I look forward to seeing you if we do get up there.
Thanks, Bruce.
Thanks, man.
Bruce Boudreau, back after these messages. It's Bob McCallum. It's John Shannon. Again, our thanks to Bruce Gabby Boudreau, who, as his nickname would imply, is never short of sentences.
Short of sentences. Yes, he is short, but
he is not short, but not of sentences.
That's right.
Does he get another job?
I think so. Yeah, I do. I mean, I think that his personality is one that endears himself to a lot of people. And I do think he's changed with the times. So if you look at Seattle, I think that, you know, I do think he'll get an interview there. I think he'll get an interview in Buffalo for sure. And there are a couple other jobs available that I wouldn't be surprised that he gets a chance to show his wares one more time.
Well, we wish him well. And we will wait and see how things develop over the next few months. That'll do it for us. We thank you for listening, watching, or whatever the hell you're doing. John Shannon just put his glasses back on. Now I can recognize him. For Shannon McCowan, we'll see you tomorrow. Goodbye, everybody.